Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We took yesterday off, but that's because we're going to give you a special Friday episode after game four of the NBA finals. But first, we got to get to some news here. A reminder that we are sponsored today by Harry's. Go to harrys.com/capspace right now to redeem a special offer. $5 off one of their shave sets. And Lyft, if you want to drive for Lyft, work for the company that treats you better. Go to lyft.com/capspace. That's a URL, and you can get a $500 new driver bonus. All right, what do we got here for news, Danny? Let's get started with that, and then we'll do De'Aaron Fox prospect report, followed by the scintillating Charlotte Hornets offseason.
I think the biggest thing, even though we've talked about it before, is just that Chris Bosh, that it is formalized by Ira Winderman, that he is basically off their books. They kind of accelerated the process that it sounds like they're going to use in the new CBA. And so that means Miami has this clarification as they go into the summer of 2017.
Yeah, Bosh, in fact, has been found by the new fitness to play panel that he is not capable of playing NBA basketball at this moment. The one difference that I'm aware of with what the new process is going to be, this was kind of a hybrid process from the new process and the old process, was normally you'd have to wait 9 months to apply basically for reinstatement to show that you're capable of playing NBA basketball again, to sign with another team. And even at this point, you wouldn't have anyone, you wouldn't have any possibility of coming back onto Miami's books. But Bosh will not have to wait for that. If he can get a team to sign off on him, he can go back to the panel. And if there's a way for him to play and a team that is interested in signing him, then the panel can make a new ruling and clear him to play potentially. We also heard that Markelle Fultz will only be working out for the Boston Celtics as of now. Much of the talk out of Boston and Fultz's talk itself has been an indication that they're going to be selecting him. He took a bunch of media photo ops with like the banners and stuff today. So it certainly would be odd if they don't end up drafting him. And, sources say Chad Ford reporting today that he's atop their draft board right now. And while they are going to consider everyone else, it'd be pretty surprising for something to happen between now and the draft to remove him from the top of their draft board.
And that's also, I guess, interesting in light of the idea that they could potentially trade the pick, though both of us don't think that's going to happen. But you also don't see players just like randomly work out like for the Chicago Bulls or something like that. So I'm not reading too much into that. The other piece that I thought was particularly interesting is there had been some speculation after game two that Ty Lue was going to change the starting lineup. The one that had been murmured in the locker room after game two was Amon Shumpert in place of J.R. Smith. And today at shoot around practice, whatever it was called today, Lou clarified that the starting lineup is going to stay the same. And so that's notable in terms of the reporting and just to see if Cleveland's going to try to change it up or kind of keep doing what they've been doing.
Yeah, and I think that's the right move. They just, as we said, they got to get J.R. going, they got to get Tristan Thompson going, or they're going to lose the series. Taking those guys out of the game is not a solution to me. I mean, and keeping them in might not be a solution either, but you're basically giving yourself no chance if you can't get those guys who are probably your fourth and fifth best players to play well. The conclusion, perhaps, although this thing will probably never be over, at least in our eyes, Donatas Mata-Yunas has left Wasserman and BJ Armstrong. He is now signed at Octagon. And given how his situation was handled, I certainly understand that move.
Yeah, I mean, for those who want more on this, this was the topic, I think, relative to the amount of time everybody else talked about it. This is probably our biggest disparity with any other basketball podcast because you and I just found this whole saga so fascinating. So if you want to listen to it, you can go back through. But yeah, I mean, think about where he is now and the money that he's made versus what would have happened if all he does is shows up for that physical. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it basically cost him $6 million this year, because if he just showed up for the Rockets physical, which he declined to show up for, presumably on the advice of his agent, because the Rockets weren't willing to match the incentives that were in the contract that they negotiated with the Nets. If he just shows up to that physical and then the Rockets say he can't play, he still could then go back and signed with the Nets. But by not showing up, there are these specific provisions in the CBA that fix it, so you have massive penalties if you try to avoid getting matched by not showing up at the physical, meaning that you can't sign with that team for 1 year. And they had $7 million guaranteed. They presumably were comfortable with his physical, even if the Rockets weren't. So by not showing up, he basically cost himself, or his agent cost him, depending on what the dynamics were, $6 million. That's bad.
It is bad. We also got the finalists finalists for the Bucks GM job per Woj, Zanuck, Wes Wilcox, and Karnisovas of the Denver Nuggets. I think those are probably at least two of the three best options on that wide-ranging list that had been floating around before that, and hopefully they make the right decision from here.
Yeah, Zanuck, it was reported by Woj that his candidacy had significant internal momentum, and I know that he's well-regarded there by the people that he works with, and Wilcox and Arturas Karnišovas, I know both of them as well. They're both really smart basketball minds, and we've talked about them before on previous podcasts, so any of them I think are qualified, but it does seem like reading the tea leaves that Zanuck would be the leader right now for that. Last here, Furkan Korkmaz, the 26th pick, a Turkish wing, kind of thin score shooter type, played for Anadolu Efes this year. He is traveling to Philadelphia, wants to be in the NBA. He has a $2 million buyout that the increase in the rookie scale will help him with a little bit, but still would be a little bit of a haircut there to get out of that. The Sixers, definitely, I think it's in their interest to stash him again. You'd rather have him on that cheap rookie contract for longer, and that worked out great for them with Dario Saric, because if Saric had come over when he was drafted, he would already be extension eligible, and he's only 1 year into his career now. So we'll see what ends up happening there. He apparently wants to even play some summer league. We've seen guys play summer league sometimes and then go back to Europe as well, but I haven't seen much of Korkmaz in the last year. It'd be interesting to see if he plays at Eurobasket. Maybe we can get more of a read on him at that point.
Yeah, and Philly already has a lot of roster spots tied up in guys that they already like, so maybe having another year to clarify with various players could work out.
All right, I wanted to bring back a little feature here. We won't do four random questions, but let's do two. My first one for you is, will Julius Randle ever be a quality starter?
I don't think so. I'm not going to write it off. People get so mad when you always say something like no to that. I think it's less likely than more likely. And the reason why is a couple of basic personality traits. So one is, he's not like a stopper defensively. I don't think that he can hold up at center.
You mean not necessarily personality traits, but
yeah,
but, you know, just traits of his game. Yeah.
Correct. So I don't think that he can hold up as a starting center for a lot of defensive reasons. He has certain parts of the build, but I don't think the defensive intelligence, activity level, anything like that is up there, the rim protection parts of it.
Length.
Yeah, those sorts of things. And then offensively, he's an intriguing talent. I mean, he's better with the ball in his hands than most guys his size, but I don't trust his jump shot yet. And those abilities are beneficial, but not essential and hard to maximize, especially on a good team. So I think that he still can provide lots of value either as a second unit center or power forward and stopgap, kind of that sort of thing. But no, I don't expect him to be a starter.
Yeah, he does have quick feet. I think really though, to be a guy that can be extremely effective on both ends, you know, maybe like the hope for him is he could become like Blake Griffin defensively. And Blake Griffin has actually become an okay defensive player. But I don't think that Julius is as explosive as him. He could be a very much a Blake Griffin light. But I think to be a quality player, he's got to shoot more threes and make them. And I think he's a long way away from that, of course. And maybe he'll get there. I'm not going to preclude that as a possibility, but it is something that he hasn't come close to doing yet in his career. He shot a few more down the end of last year, but to say that that's a shot that you want him taking on a good team, or either that, or he's got to be fit next to a center who can shoot threes on one end and block shots on the other end. And good luck finding that.
You ready for my question?
No, let's tease it. Well, here, you ask the question and then we'll do a commercial and then I'll answer it. How about that?
I like it. So I was writing the Suns offseason preview for SI before we recorded this, and I was working on a section on Eric Bledsoe. And so one of the questions that I was thinking about was, where would I like to see him among realistic options? Where would I like to see him play basketball next year?
Oh, God, I want to answer this so badly, but first we got to make some money here. And the way we're going to do that is by telling you how you can make some money. And that's by joining Lyft, the ride-sharing company that believes in treating its people better. I think everyone knows at this point why you'd want to drive for a ride-sharing company. You can turn the app on and off basically whenever you want. If you have a couple of spare hours, if you need to get a second job, nobody's going to be like, oh yeah, just come in for 2 hours whenever you want. If you're working for Lyft, you could do that. People who drive for Lyft include seniors who are retired and want to make a little extra money, families who are trying to pay for maybe their child's braces. If you're trying to save up for a new couch or a new purchase if you have another job, or even if you want to make it your primary living, you can do that as well. And why is Lyft better? Only Lyft offers in-app tipping. You keep 100% of those tips. Drivers have been paid over $150 million in tips since the feature was introduced. I always tip when I ride with Lyft, at least 20%, if not more. They also have this express pay feature that lets drivers get paid almost instantly. You don't have to wait for weeks. They have a new device that makes picking up your passengers easier with color coding so they can find you very easily. It's really simple. Happy drivers mean happy passengers, and that's why 9 out of 10 Lyft rides get a perfect 5-star rating. The way to get started with Lyft, go to lyft.com, lyft.com/capspace. Capspace URL, easy to remember because we talk about Capspace all the time on the program, as we will today with the Charlotte Hornets. And if you go to that URL, you can get a $500 new driver bonus. Their application and vetting process usually takes about a week or so. And then you can start riding. No, not riding. I ride. You can start driving and start getting some cash in your pocket. Limited time only. Terms apply. All right. So where would I like to see Eric Bledsoe? I think Utah would be number one, assuming that they bring back Gordon Hayward, of course. And that's a team that realistically could trade for him. And I would like to just see him running the show for a good team. You know, we haven't really seen him other than that one first year that he was in Phoenix get a chance to be on a good team. And I'd like to see him get in the playoffs and see what he could do. I think Minnesota might be another one where it would be nice to see him, and then he could even guard some bigger players as a stopper. They do some more switching because he's got that strong body, a great length as well. Milwaukee would be extremely interesting, although I don't know if they really have the assets to get it done. Not the Knicks. Yeah, those are probably the biggest ones for me. Anyone that you thought of that I missed there?
So one with a caveat. So if the Knicks were able to get him without giving up their pick this year, then I would see it as an interesting stopgap type thing where they could get him for 2 years. And then
what about the sorry triangle, though? Like, that's why they're just such a shit show.
That's
there.
True.
Like,
I wasn't thinking about the triangle. I was just thinking about having a competent point guard with Porzingis.
It'd be awesome to see him run pick and pop with Porzingis. They're going to run that 4 times a game. Congratulations.
That's true. That's a very good point. So yeah, that would be another one. And like, so for me, the reason why a team like Chicago isn't on the list is just because I don't think they can put it all together, not only in terms of an offer, but just by just getting good enough. We've talked about this with them before about the idea of trading Jimmy Butler. So for me, the A1 is really Utah, if it's possible. I think that they also have the assets to get it done, whether that's young players. We talked about the idea of my advocacy for Derek Favors being included in a trade like that. I think he would really help Phoenix's kind of big man rotation as they're figuring this all out, or they can use draft assets, whatever else they want to do. And Milwaukee would be great. As you said, there is that limitation, but I just think he could elevate their ceiling. And I also don't think that having Bledsoe is mutually exclusive with Brogdon. I think they could play together, they could play separately, and sure. Bledsoe's contract is not prohibitive, so I don't think that really challenges them in terms of where they're going long term financially. So I think the idea would be have Bledsoe for these years, then you can be more competitive as you wait for Brogdon, Thon Maker, and ideally Jabari Parker to get to where they need to be.
What about Jabari Parker and one of their bad center contracts for Bledsoe?
I mean, I would do that if I were Phoenix. Absolutely.
You would not do that if you were Milwaukee? I mean, you know I love Parker. He's one of my favorite players to watch in the league, but given 2 ACL tears now to the same knee, he's about to get expensive. We have no idea if he's going to stay healthy. He's got a lot of defensive limitations as well. He's got better this year, but still a little bit of ways from maybe playing winning basketball on both ends. There are a lot of questions, and Eric Bledsoe still under contract for 2 more years now.
Yeah, his contract's amazing. It's 2 years about a combined $30 million, which is incredible. And so
I think I probably wouldn't do it just because Parker still gives you so much upside, but there's also a question of his fit with Giannis as well.
Well, but so here's you could have a thing that I think teams should do more often is the idea of kind of sweeteners coming back. So maybe you could say that the Suns are getting the best offer. So if they included, let's say, Marquise Chris or somebody else, maybe a lower asset than that in the trade, then we start to get a little bit of traction there. And you could work something in with all those type of guys. But yeah.
Yeah, or even like a TJ Warren might be someone, because he's someone who's going to
get expensive
to get paid,
too.
Same draft class. You know, give them some scoring off the bench, which I think they could really use as well. Never going to happen, but it is interesting. I mean, we've had such difficulty calibrating what Parker's value might be in an extension, and obviously his trade value would be similarly difficult. It certainly would be a team taking a risk who's willing to try to just, you know, make the upside play. And you can make the argument maybe that if you have Giannis on your team, you can say, all right, we need to, this is our only chance at getting another star, but maybe that's Thon Maker. I don't think he can be a superstar, but he can be a very solid player. Or you can say, hey, you know what? Like, can we really take a risk of paying someone who could get injured at any time, like $20, $25 million a year next to Giannis? And now if something happens to him, like, we're screwed for the next 4 years?
Especially because in a way the Suns would be doing it sight unseen. I mean, they can't know where he's going to recover to because he's not recovered yet.
Yeah, they do have a great training staff.
They do.
It's actually ironic if they traded for him since it was in Phoenix that he tore his ACL that first time. But all right, let's get to De'Aaron Fox here. This is rare for me, and I'm sure rare for listeners of this podcast. I don't really have like that strong of an opinion on Fox either way. You know, I don't see him as a superstar. He also really, to me, other than his shooting, which I think is not going to be that terrible, I think he can get to be passable there. I think he kind of seems like someone who can be a quality starting point guard for a long time. But, you know, I don't necessarily see him being better than like, you know, Eric Bledsoe at his peak, that type of player. You know, I don't see him necessarily becoming a top five point guard in the NBA. It's not impossible because he is a very athletic guy, but he has a long way to go to get there, even if he doesn't have any obvious weaknesses as a prospect other than the shooting.
I'm sure we'll talk about the shooting at some point, but what struck me at one point during this time, I watched a lot of his assists, is that he's a good passer. He's good at finding the open guy, which, you know, a lot of high school and college point guards can't do. But I very rarely saw him kind of passing a guy open or seeing something that was really impressive. And that's concerning to me just because you look at kind of the two different elements that can really hold a modern point guard back. One of them is the lack of a pull-up jumper because you can defend them very differently. The second is just not having that reliable shot creation for others. Like, those are two things that can be limiting for a good athlete, for a good kid, doesn't really matter. If you can't do either of those, it's a problem. I think that he will be able to figure both of those out. I think there's entirely a chance, but it's far from certain, and that makes me a little bit uncomfortable with him.
I thought his passing was very solid. It's not to the point where I'd say I feel uncomfortable about him. To me, he wasn't like, he's finding the open guy. You know, there wasn't like a ton of watching film where it's like, oh, this guy was open, he didn't throw it to him. You know, he played pick and roll. He makes the right reads. It's not, you know, he's not like just, oh my God, how the hell did he see that type of plays? But, you know, how many passers are there like that really in the NBA at the point guard position? You know, there's maybe five or six that you would look at that way. He can do what needs to be done out of pick and roll, I think. So I thought he had a really nice feel for entering the ball into the post. He threw some really nice alley-oops to Bam Adebayo. And, you know, he doesn't really pass much with his right hand. He's left-handed. He definitely plays very left side forward. You know, you'll see that from a lot of left-handed guys, even if they're just dribbling the ball, facing the basket straight, like his left foot and the left side of his body is always kind of in front of his left. But his right hand is developing. He's not like a Zoolander type of guy at the rim. Another thing that he had a good feel for was just in transition, he would take a couple of steps to drive in and then just kind of flash in front of the guy guarding a shooter and then just pitch back to that shooter for a three. You know, he had a nice feel for those type of plays. Give you some basics on him. 6'4". 6'6.5 wingspan. It's only measured at about 170 pretty consistently throughout his career, and that definitely shows that lack of heft. We'll get to that more when we talk about his defense. I think athletically he's explosive, especially off of 1 foot, and he can explode from odd angles, especially in transition. He's got really nice euro steps, can jump off at either foot. You know, he'll kind of be, it seems like, ambling to the goal, and all of a sudden he'll take off and explode past this guy in the air. Also really fast in transition, can push the ball hard. He'll definitely be a problem for teams in transition, and he's a decent rebounder as a grab and go guy. Not amazing, but solid there. And he's also reputed to be a great character kid. Very impressive interview. I mean, the interviews that you see of him, you know, you're pretty much blown away by that kind of stuff. And that's in contrast maybe to Dennis Smith, who does not particularly impress it in those sorts of areas.
Right. And
it's
not always clear how that kind of stuff is going to translate. Obviously, as a point guard, the team takes more of your personality if you have the ball in your hands. People draw to magic on that, but I think that's totally fair. And he is, I think of him in an interesting way as being unselfish on the court in a way that I think guys would enjoy playing with him, that he he's unselfish really with his energy. So he pushes the ball hard, but he's not always doing it just to get his own shot. And I feel like whether he's a second unit guy early in his career or he's a starter, people will like playing with him in that way.
I agree with you there. Let's get to the ugly part, though. His jump shot. Give you some stats. No, well, actually, I'll say this first. It doesn't look awful. Like, he looks pretty smooth taking it. He's not, like, doesn't have, like, some awful hitch in it. You know, he kind of gets it. His elbow flexed past 90 degrees, and it shoots it off the top of his head a little bit. It's a little bit more out than up. It's not amazing. You know, he kind of turns his body to the side as well. Again, left foot forward is kind of how he plays. But he still shot 74% from the foul line. That's not horrendous. You know, he's not. The real thing that makes you worry is this guy can't shoot free throws, and he's shooting a really poor percentage on jumpers. That said, he's shooting a really poor percentage on jumpers. 38 out of 136 on jump shots, 28%, only 32% e-field goal percentage. Doesn't get any better on catch and shoots. 5 out of 27 on unguarded catch and shoots, which is horrendous, and 10 out of 41 on jump shots out of the pick and roll, 27% on three-pointers, taking about 15% of his shots from behind the arc.
And what's so concerning to me about that, more so than the lack of success, is the lack of frequency. Because if teams aren't worried about you shooting, they're just going to sag off. And then the advantages that you create by being faster than everybody else matter less.
Now, the lack of jumper didn't make him totally inefficient.
Right.
55% true shooting, which is okay, not amazing. But he got to the foul line a ton, especially in transition. 47% free throw rate, which is outstanding. And with that slight body, he's able to get a little bit of a step on guys. And then, you know, he's one of the few guys that we saw in college who can kind of do the feel contact and throw it up and get a foul. And usually that'll happen closer to the rim. But especially because he's not the strongest guy, when there is illegal contact, he's able to accentuate that and get to the foul line. Is really a very nice free throw rate for someone with his game, and he's got the ability. All right, if you're gonna back up on me, I'm just gonna come right at you still. You know, if they go under on him, he'll re-screen, get into the lane. His floater game, surprisingly enough, is excellent. 20 out of 42 on runners, which obviously is fantastic, and he killed UCLA on those in that massive 38 point game that he had in the regional semifinals, which you may remember, Danny. But so I think, and he's got a decent amount of craft in the pick and roll. He can, if they go over the screen, he can get guys on his back and then kind of bump them off and then go into his floater game. And obviously, if he draws the defense, he makes the right passes. He can find the roll man. He can find guys for alley-oops. He's got some moves too. You know, he can throw out a pretty ridiculous crossover at times. You know, he's not like going through these massive dribbling exhibitions, but if he needs to make a quick move, you know, one or two moves, either an inside out or a crossover, he can string one or two moves together, and with his quickness, that's all he needs to create separation. And the real question about him is, I mean, let's say, Danny, there's like one or two paths for him, right? Let's say one or three paths. Let's say he becomes a shooter, like, say, on the level of like Goran Dragic or Mike Conley, all guys, and maybe even Kyle Lowry, although Lowry is even a level beyond those guys, I think. But, you know, a guy who, hey, actually like shoots in the high 30s on threes and can shoot when you go under on the screen. And that's a pretty nasty player. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but you know, we've seen guys who are this bad as shooters but shoot okay from the foul line get to that level. You know, that's 8 years from now that he would be there, and that's a pretty nasty player, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's a fringe all-star, probably not an all-NBA guy, but that's a wonderful place to be for a player. And
well, I think he's more athletic than any of those guys. You know, I mean, I think if you combine, and it has as much or more size than any of those guys too, if you combine that level of shooting with the speed that he has getting to the basket, what he can do in transition, I think his defense, which we'll get to, can be very, very good. He gets a lot of steals. Like, maybe he even could be, you know, an all-NBA type of performer. But, you know, you're projecting a lot to say that he's going to get to that type of level.
Right, and that's kind of the bigger point, is that you have these kind of two steps down. I'm guessing you're going to say that the next one, or do you want to do the bottom first, or do you want to do the middle?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, sort of the middle tier would be maybe like a John Wall type of shooter. You know, Wall has been a very suspect shooter, always been a good free throw shooter, though. You know, maybe he, Fox gets to that kind of a level. And, you know, I wouldn't say that he, if that's the case, you know, I would say he is significantly less physical talent than John Wall would. But, you know, I think he would just be kind of a solid starter, maybe, you know, 10th, 15th best point guard in the league if he's that type of shooter.
To me, Drew Holiday's the comp there.
Drew, I think Drew is, you know, he's shot high 30s a lot. So, I mean, I think he's closer to the kind of Lowry. He just doesn't get his shot off as quickly as those
That's
guys,
fair.
I guess. Yeah. You know, maybe Schroeder, although he's probably a level even below that. Or like, you know, like a Jeremy Lin type of shooter, like that kind of guy, maybe. Reggie Jackson, like that level of shooter where it's like, all right, you know, if you go under, he'll make it sometimes, but like you're not freaking out. And then there's the question of, all right, what if he becomes Elfrid Payton or Andre Miller or someone like that? You know, can Emmanuel Mudiay, although, you know, the jury's still out on whether Mudiay can get there as a shooter. That's a good question. How do you think he compares to Mudiay as a prospect?
I think Mudiay was a better passer. I thought he had better vision and he saw more. I also liked that Mudiay, it looked like to me like he was stronger, but Fox brings a lot of the intangibles in other ways. I think that he plays with more vigor, which I really, really like with Fox.
Yeah. And faster in transition, yeah. More explosive.
And also
probably better defensive talent.
And I like Fox's instincts defensively a lot better. And really at this stage, the body part is important, but I liked what Fox kind of the way that you'd see certain plays with him be like, okay, he gets this better than most guys his age. And that was very encouraging. That was also something we saw way back at the Nike Hoop Summit back in 2016.
Also worth noting, although it was a short season, Mudiay shot in the 30s from NBA three-point range in China. And,
that's true.
You know, his first year in the NBA, he shot, you know, in the 30s. Pretty bad on jump shot, certainly. It was one of the most inefficient rookies that we've ever seen. You know, I do think that what I like about Fox, though, is despite the shooting limitations, despite the fact you wouldn't look at him as like, oh, this guy's an unbelievable scorer, with the free throws, the floaters, like he finds a way to get shots up. You know, he had a 27% usage rate on what was a pretty loaded Kentucky team and a team that was playing some spacing challenge lineups at times as well, with Isaiah Briscoe and Wendy and Gabriel starting together for a lot of the season. Things really opened up when they would go to Willis at the four. But yeah, I think he seems like someone who, again, is like, all right, you know, he's going to score pretty solidly. Is he going to be a dominant scorer? Probably not. Is he going to be a dominant passer? Probably not, but he could be a solid passer. You know, is he maybe he'll have the ability to be a very good defensive player, but as a point guard, especially with the offensive responsibilities, there just aren't that many dominant defensive point guards in the league, especially as they get a little bit older. You know, can he be a dominant finisher? Probably not, but he could be a good finisher for a point guard. Certainly, he's explosive. Doesn't really have a lot of one-hand finishes or craft yet. Doesn't get much extension, so I think he'll be solid, but not amazing in that area. What about defensively? What did you see from him there, Danny?
Couple different fundamental components. One is I like the way he moves. So on closeouts, he does well. When he kind of has to shuffle his feet, I think he does pretty well. But he's so slight. He's just a small guy in terms of frame. And he can get bigger. I expect him to get bigger. Hopefully he can do that without losing that quickness. So that makes him less switchable than you would expect when you see a guy who has like a 6'6 wingspan. You go, oh man, he can guard some twos and all that kind of stuff. It's like, no, he's going to have to become a very different physical person in order to be able to do that.
Yeah, he'll at most be a two-position defender. And I think you're right. He's going to have to get stronger because, you know, if he had to guard like Bradley Beal, right? Like Bradley Beal could just get a shoulder into him, knock him backwards, and then just pull up for a jumper very easily. Like when opposing point guards would get a shoulder by him, he wasn't able really to affect their shots. And not a great like block percentage, for example. I mean, you know, you don't expect that out of your point guard, but he wasn't really able to affect guys at the rim in the way that like Alonzo Ball or Markel Fultz would. And he doesn't have, you know, much worse physical tools in some ways than those guys do, but in part because he's so slight, if there's any contact, he's just going to get knocked backwards and not really be able to affect his man at the rim at this point. We've seen a lot of guys like him get a lot stronger too, so I'm not willing to preclude him getting there by any means. And getting over screens can be a little bit of an issue for him as well, again, because he's so slight. And where do you feel he is in the hierarchy? I mean, the only guy we haven't looked at really is projected that anyone's talking about going in the top five at this point has been Monk.
He's hard because I think the ceiling play on him is certainly possible, but I think it's lower, like just the expected value than somebody like Dennis Smith. But his average value is much higher because I can see what the value he can provide, even if he doesn't reach that, especially actually in limited minutes. I think if he ratcheted up his defensive intensity, because when he brings it, he's quite good defensively, but then he kind of loses it a little bit, and being in an NBA conditioning system and all that's really going to help him out. So I would probably, I haven't really pieced together exactly where I'd have him. I think he's at worst, he's in the mix with those forwards and Smith. I don't know yet if I have him above all those guys, but he's certainly in that conversation. And the biggest thing that I would want to see, you talked about his jumper in a couple different ways. Something that was shocking to me when I watched him was he has some shots where he just lets the ball go too early or too late. You know, like he shoots it a little bit on the way up or a little bit on the way down. And I think of that as something that can be fixed, but it's just weird to see in a guy who is as good as he is. And so what I would do is you sit there like Sacramento or Orlando or one of these teams in that mix and watch him shoot a ton of jumpers in your own gym. Ideally, if you can have somebody there to maybe give him some coaching to see if he can handle direction. And if you feel like that lower scenario is less realistic and it's more the middle and the upper, then I would be on board with him being a higher end prospect.
Yeah, I think workout's going to be very interesting. He's had a lot of visits, actually. He actually did visit, apparently, with Sacramento, who had the fifth pick. I think he's trying to establish that as a floor. Chad Ford saying today that he thought that would be his floor at five, and that seems reasonable to me. Yeah, that's going to be a very big question, right? If he comes in and he's able to hit shots, or even like heat up to where at times he's hitting shots, you know, if it's just awful misses again, and you start to worry about it. I think that he's a guy for whom workouts, not even necessarily workouts against competition, but just one-on-one workouts in the gym. And I really don't know enough about the workout process to say, all right, here's how that translates. But at least if he's hitting shots in a workout setting, you feel like, all right, it's possible, you know, whereas if he's still hitting those, then if he still can't hit it. And it's like, all right, there's another data point now that confirms that he's shot very poorly. To answer my own question, just based on what I see on film, again, this is just film, I would have Dennis Smith ahead of him. I would probably have him ahead of Jonathan Isaac, but I think it'd be pretty close. And, you know, I think I would still have Fox ahead of Tatum or ahead of Josh Jackson. Smith to me is just, he's more explosive. He's got more ball skills. I don't think that Smith is really that much below Fox as a passer, maybe a little bit, but obviously played on a much, much worse team. But just his ability to get to the basket as a finisher, shoot open threes pretty well, especially from a standstill, won't be the defender that Fox is probably, although Smith might actually be a better switch guy than Fox just because he'll get a little stronger. There's also the injury risk for Smith as well. Again, I'm not putting that into my evaluation. And obviously Fox, you just watch one interview of Fox and one interview of Smith and you'll see what we're talking about here of like, you know, why people are high on Fox's character and don't say the same thing necessarily about Smith. Not that Smith comes off as like a bad guy or anything, but he doesn't impart the sort of wisdom really that it seems like Fox has and polish. But I'm not considering that. You know, I don't have access to those reports. I don't know them personally. I haven't sat down with them. And even the people who have probably don't really know how much that type of thing should be weighted. So I would say just based on the film, I would have Smith ahead of Fox at this point. But I certainly would understand someone who liked Fox better. I think that Smith just has the upside to be a top 5 point guard. And I don't necessarily see that from Fox unless his jumper just absolutely blows up.
Something I wanted to ask you, because you watched more film of him shooting than I did. Did you ever see Fox shoot from beyond, like right at the 3-point line?
No, absolutely not.
Because that's a concern as well, because when you expand the line out, then that could really hurt somebody who's missing, who, and also, you know, he missed short sometimes, but it's just that pushback of a little bit could really matter for him.
All right, we'll be right back with the Charlotte Hornets offseason. But first, this from Harry's: Father's Day is just around the corner, and dads are impossible to shop for. Those surly dads, so gruff. But if you get them a Harry shave kit, maybe they'll shave and not look quite as gruff and intimidating. And the way you do that is you can go to harrys.com/capspace and get $5 off one of their shave sets that includes a limited edition Father's Day set. Comes with a storm gray razor handle, chrome razor stand, which is actually sitting on my bathroom counter right now, and their foaming shave gel, which I know you are a fan of, Danny.
I am. It's a really great product. I will use
what it. What makes it? What makes it better than like the other? To get into some analysis, what makes it better to you than like some of the other ones that you've tried?
A couple different things. So it foams up after you get it out of the bottle, so that means you use less of it. Like I found myself using less, which is great in terms of economy, just because it, you know, you can get more efficient. More efficiency, something you and I both like in basketball players and in shave gel. And it's comfortable on your skin, and I think it does a really it soothes it does everything that shave gel is supposed to do. And I've basically just adapted to using it full time. Ever since I used it the first time, it's surprising, because I'm kind of a brand loyalist sometimes with these sorts of things, but when something impressive impresses me, I'm going to keep using it until something else comes along and nothing has.
Yeah, and thanks to their 100% quality guarantee, if for some reason you don't agree with the great Danny LaRue, they'll give you a full refund. If you are not happy, Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price. Now you don't have to go to the drugstore and ask them to unlock those ridiculous cabinets that store these apparently incredibly valuable name brand razors with a device that looks like the nuclear football, just so you can like take this thing home, pay way too much for it, and go shave. Harry's doesn't mark their stuff up like that. So once again, harrys.com/capspace right now to redeem that special offer, $5 off one of their shave sets. harrys.com/capspace for $5 off. And of course, let them know that you came from us. Now, the scintillating offseason of the Charlotte Hornets. They are capped out basically forever and ever, for eternity, forever.
Pretty much. And they have an unusual kind of set of circumstances because they have five different players that are making between $12 million and $13.2 million next season. Some of those are good contracts. Kemba Walker is a great contract. And then some of them, Miles Plumlee, are distinctly not great. And that creates a challenge for them because to really change their overall situation would require much larger moves than I expect them to want to make or to be capable of making.
Yeah, and it's really a shame in some respects because I think Walker is the best contract in the league, maybe, that goes for longer than next year at $12 million for an all-star caliber of player. We'll see whether he can repeat that performance again this year. But, you know, they've got like $7 million for Jeremy Lamb and $6 million for Marco Bellinelli. And I think Zeller is a good deal, $12.6 million this year. He's got a four-year $56 million extension that he signed last fall. I mean, I think he's a quality starting center. We saw what happened to them when they didn't have him last year. But yeah, Plumlee making $12.5 million for three more years after this one. He's already in his late 20s. Had knee surgery, a debridement, after missing basically his entire time in Charlotte after the trade deadline with a calf injury. Marvin Williams, we kind of always knew that was going to be a little bit of an overpay. I think he's probably about properly paid right now, but he had a small cap hold, and then they increased that via the most they could pay him with the early bird exception last season. Batum, again, he had a smaller cap hold. They bumped him up, so that's why they're basically up against the cap this year, because they exceeded the cap last year with those bird rights. I do think that this is a team that was better than they were able to show last year, just due to their problems with depth. And whenever Zeller was out there, off of, they're like, you know, 3-21 or something when Zeller didn't play. But he has been injury prone at times in his career, and it may be that he isn't quite strong enough to hold up as a full time center and not get injured. So I could see them, maybe if they keep this cast together, add a little bit around the margins, getting back to being, you know, something like a 7 seed or a 6 seed in the East this year. There's really nobody that you look at below the top four teams in the East that's looking like they're going to exceed 45 wins. We'll see what happens in the offseason. But so they could definitely get back to maybe being a 5 seed. It's just their chances for moving beyond there seem very small given the limited resources now at hand.
Yeah, it's a challenging spot. And the other thing that's a little bit frustrating is one of their kind of needs that I see is ideally something like what they had with Jeremy Lin. You're obviously not going to get Jeremy Lin again, but the idea of a point guard who can both back up Kemba and play with him was a wonderful fit. Steve Clifford did a nice job of integrating that type of player. It's very hard to find somebody like that, even if you have the full mid-level exception.
And they should have that. There are really two scenarios here, depending upon the team option of Ramon Sessions, who missed the end of the year as well with another knee surgery. They have until June 29th to decide to keep him at $6.3 million for next year or let him go, and they could always re-sign him too, although he would be unrestricted if they declined that team option. So if they don't have him on the books with their draft pick number 11, they're looking at right about $6 million over the cap, which leaves them about $14 million below the tax, which Michael Jordan will pay on a cold day in hell. So I think that my most likely for them is that they decline Sessions' team option, and then they would have close to enough room to use the full MLE, starting up to a four-year contract starting at $8.4 million. And then also the BAE, which we haven't talked about much, but that actually is a little bit more powerful now in this new CBA. You can give a two-year contract starting at about $3 million a year now, a little bit over that, $3.3 million a year with the BAE. So they could probably use both of those and still still have a little room to fit in around the margins to operate to avoid the tax, or, you know, maybe make a small move to get under the tax once they get to the trade deadline.
Another very important team building piece that they have is the 11th overall pick. You know, one of the benefits of having a worse than expected season is that you get a better draft pick. And at 11, they're probably going to be at the mercy of just who's on the board. And that player likely is not going to help them this season, but it's still a nice piece to have when you're looking for cost-controlled potential rotation players moving forward. And the 11 pick has been successful recently, including Miles Turner.
Really? That's I don't think Charlotte fans were aware of that. What do you think that they need? You mentioned additional creation. When Walker was off the floor, they really struggled to score. Batum, really the only other guy who can create anything off the dribble on this team. Sessions can do that a little bit, but, you know, again, if they're not going to bring him back, and he's getting into his 30s now. So I think they definitely need a better solution at backup point guard. But what else do you think they need outside of that?
I'd like to see them bring in another wing just with a different skill set. I'm not the biggest fan of Bellinelli or Lamb, and yeah, Batum and Marvin and MKG are all good players, but you need more depth there, especially since the league is going smaller, and the more that you can play those guys in kind of some of those switchy lineups, I think that could work very well with their talent. So if they could get somebody who is worth a spot in the rotation, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, Lamb, Bellinelli, those guys, I mean, I think they've played effectively at times. You know, those aren't like bad backup wings, but yeah, you can always use more of them. But they do have two guys who can play as combo forwards, MKG and Marvin Williams as well. I mean, I actually think what their second biggest need is, you're going to laugh at this, backup center.
Ugh, I think you might be right, but that's just so depressing.
Like, I'm not sure if Plumlee is even a quality backup. They certainly overpaid to get him. Kaminsky failed pretty badly as a center defensively. I mean, maybe your plan can be, all right, he's going to play center, we'll just outscore people on the second unit. There's certain matchups maybe where that could work. And, you know, Kaminsky still is going to have to hit more of his shots as well. We've talked quite a bit about him. And then, you know, whether is he a backup power forward? He's kind of stuck in between. How many minutes can he play? Can you defend when he's on the floor? All those are questions. So, I mean, yeah, it would be nice if they had someone on this team who could block a shot. They really just don't have any. I mean, Marvin Williams might be their best shot blocker on this team. And Marvin is going to start slowing down. So just getting, you know, this could be a year that he falls off a cliff. So getting someone else, maybe who could be good there. But we'll assume that they're not going to look for another big, you know, unless it's kind of a project guy who's going to be essentially their fifth big.
But yeah, and that might be what they use their draft pick on, depending on supply. Because it sounds like, from what I'm hearing, that's kind of a spot where there are going to be some bigs. So maybe you just take that guy, hope it works out.
Yeah. Well, and they need some more American white centers on this team too. So Zach Collins, I think, would fit perfectly. Michael Jordan, for some reason, loves like white American centers. Who do you think could be a good fit for them in free agency if they were able to use their full MLE?
So as we've said, I think the priority is a backup one. I'm not sure he would be interested, but Deron Williams would be a decent enough fit. A bigger guy can do that. I've thought about the idea. I don't think he would take the full thing. If Langston Galloway declined his player option, he would be restricted, but I'm not sure the Kings are so gung-ho about bringing him back. Galloway could be an interesting guy for them.
I don't think he's a good fit because he can't do anything off the dribble. Like, they got to have somebody, to me, who can run a pick and roll and create a little bit. That's not really Galloway's game to me.
Right. What I'm thinking about with him is more that he fills part of that role, not the whole thing. It's hard. I think that you're probably going to look for a different, you're not going to be able to find a single player who can do both things. So the backup point guard market, you know, it's kind of the standard, you know, Ty Lawson, Jose Calderon type guys, maybe Ray Felton, something like that.
I was thinking more along the lines of Tyreke Evans. And it's funny, we found a lot of these teams really that need guys like that. Like, maybe his market, even someone like Rodney Suckey could have a higher market, but just somebody who can create shots. So I thought Tyreke Evans would be one on it, maybe on more of a make good contract. I don't think he would want to lock in for more than 1 year at only MLE money. So maybe like a 1+1 for him. Obviously a huge injury risk there though. Rodney Stuckey, he's 31, but maybe just someone who can create a shot. I mean, I wouldn't spend the full MLE on him, but just he might be maybe like more of a BAE type of candidate. Ty Lawson, only problem there is it's difficult to play him together with Walker because they're both pretty small point guards, but it's bringing him back to North Carolina could be something that they could look at.
I've got an idea to throw at you.
Sure.
With kind of the reporting that his contract works like what just happened with Stuckey's, Monte Ellis, if the Pacers don't really have a place for him, the Hornets have a ton of filler salary. Maybe you could even run something with those two guys and maybe Jeremy Lamb for Monte or something like that to clear his money off the books. Lamb makes less money this year, but has a guaranteed money for next year. Something like that could work.
Yeah, but Ellis could be a good thought, although we'll have to see what happens in Indiana with Jeff Teague's free agency as well. And if they end up moving Paul George. But yeah, he's someone that I would think of. I think Sean Livingston would be an outstanding fit, especially with the shooting that someone like Kaminsky brings on the second unit, where that would allow Livingston to get into the post, create a few shots. He could guard the other team's shooting guard if you wanted to play him with Walker a little bit. You know, he's still probably going to be limited to 20 minutes a game at this point in his career, but I think he could be a pretty good fit and someone I might consider, you know, spending like a full MLE on for like maybe 2 years, something like that, at age 31. Call.
Another one I thought of was Ron Baker. I don't think you give him the full amount, but as just kind of the idea that you're not going to get somebody who's a perfect fit. Ron's 24. He could work.
Yeah. The Knicks, of course, would have match rights on him. Another thought for these guys, too, because they are a team that is over the cap, but not particularly close to the tax yet, that they might be an option for a sign and trade. Someone like Rudy Gay, perhaps, you know, if they were to give him a 3-year, $36 million deal or something in a sign and trade with the Kings. That might be something they would consider, although they would obviously have to send some salary back to the Kings that the Kings might not be that interested in there. So that's a concern. But, you know, if they sent back Lamb, you're most of the way there at that point. The Kings have 97,000 shooting guards. Maybe they wouldn't be interested, but they might be able to work out some kind of a deal there. Deion Waiters in a sign and trade might also be someone that they could consider. But again, is Miami going to want to take salary back? Probably not. The Wolves with Shabazz Muhammad, like their full MLE, probably not enough to get Muhammad, but we'll see. Maybe the Wolves are just going to not match. Maybe if they offered Shabazz a full MLE deal over 4 years, he might be interested in that. I don't know if even teams around the league think he's good, but these are all guys who can just create some shots for you, you know, which they really, I think, need pretty desperately. One of the questions that we always ask on these is, where are they in the success cycle? You know, what should their mindset be just in terms of the overall direction of the franchise? What do you think about that?
I think they have to be pretty close to it. I mean, you think about that Marvin Williams could be aging out relatively quickly. Nicolas Batum is not super old, but I think he's kind of in that stage where you wouldn't really expect him to get better. Kemba Walker was wonderful this past year, showed real improvement, but I wouldn't expect him to make another big jump. So I think the time is now.
Yeah, the time is now to chase that 5 seed in the East. But you know, that's been what has been the approach here. You know, when they got Michael Kidd-Gilchrist instead of Anthony Davis, perhaps that this fate was always kind of destined. And the hope is with Walker, maybe they could continue to compete in that area, and that would actually be good for where they've been historically since the franchise reboot in 2004. So yeah, I think you're right. I think they should go for it. I mean, I don't know if I want to be like, all right, we're going to trade the number 11 pick and try and get someone here.
Right, it's kind of like it's the Pistons, basically. It's like you want to go for it within the means that you have. You don't want to sacrifice your future assets because your present isn't good enough to sacrifice your future.
Yeah, and remember, they already traded their first rounder last year for Bellinelli as well. But yeah, I mean, this team, especially Kaminsky as well, like with him not really working out to be a star level of player, I'm not sure whether they thought he would be that or not, but with him not working out that well, it seems like, you know, this is kind of their fate. So maximize it here for a couple of years and then rebuild. I mean, if it were me just as the GM, I didn't have to worry about economic realities in that market, I might say, hey, let's see what we can get for this great contract that Kemba Walker's on for 2 more years here, and you know, let's try and rebuild. But you know, I wouldn't they still have so much dead weight. Maybe see if you could move Batum, who, you know, even he's looking like not a great contract, even though he certainly had multiple offers last year for the max.
And so with the Kemba Walker thing, another dynamic to consider for Charlotte, like if we're being their fake GM, is that he's 27 now, so he'll be in that situation kind of like Isaiah Thomas, where he's on a wonderful contract right now, but I'm not sure that I'll be comfortable giving him his next deal. So that would, to me, that would signal the kind of guy that you should consider trading at some point. Maybe that point isn't now, but let's say they're not a playoff team at the trade deadline. Maybe at that point you start to consider it, just because the future value isn't there if you don't want to sign him to his next contract.
Yeah, and maybe in the long term, the 2019 offseason, when Walker will be off the books, they'll still have another year of Plumlee at that point. They'll still have another year of Batum. MKG and Marvin Williams both have player options that year. I mean, even then, you're probably not necessarily ready to totally reboot things, but they could lose Walker, and you know, maybe they'll just be bad because they don't have much choice at that point, or maybe they could trade some of those guys so they'd finally be in the last year of their deal. Batum goes all the way out 5 years. He's got a player option for the 2020-21 season for $27 million. So
can I bring up a small point on that? So
yes.
I have a piece that I've been working on for the Sport News for months now. It's one of those, like, I just drop a couple lines on it every couple months about the mistake that they made by not front loading Batum's contract. And I think we're going to start seeing that soon, because yes, that would have made it harder in terms of the luxury tax this coming season, but they could have made that work. And then his contract looks so much more palatable if you basically reverse the structure. The issue, they couldn't have fully front loaded it because of the max, but they could have done it more than they did.
Right. Yeah, I agree. That's something that we talked about the very moment it happened, that was something that they should do when it became clear that they actually got a discount on that. I mean, really, you're not getting much of the benefit of that discount at this point. And then the impact of the Plumlee contract is next year, if they use the MLE and maybe the BAE this year, they really will have almost no room to operate under the tax whatsoever next year, even with a few free agents coming off the books. Not many. It would just really be Bellinelli. This team is locked up for a long time. It's really pretty remarkable. Like, of their top like seven guys, pretty much all of them are under contract for at least two more years. So, but that's going to be the opportunity cost. And I think even that MLE money will go even further next year. So maybe, you know, they might say, hey, we don't have anyone it's worth using the full MLE on. Maybe we'll just only use part of it, or we could split that among two people or something like that. But yeah, still not a ton of flexibility. And maybe that MLE goes further. But it is worth noting that although they were longer contracts back under the old CBAs prior to 2011, you know, we're talking 5 or 6 year deals back then. And just relatively, the MLE was higher compared to the cap under that regime than under the 2011 CBA. But now 2017, I think it's going to be more similar, other than just that there are shorter years. So we could see some of those full MLE contracts end up being really bad deals by the end of them. I think a lot of those, that'll probably be the case, because you're giving those out to guys who are in their late 20s, and they're not elite players if they're taking that type of money.
One other thing I wanted to talk about briefly with them is that they have 3 non-guaranteed contracts at this moment. Briante Weber and Johnny O'Brien, my info has it that their guarantee date is August 1st, and then Travion Graham's is basically the kind of the late time, which is in the middle of next season.
Yeah, the league cut down date of January 10th. Yeah, those guys are all at the minimum. Weber, I mean, I think his fate, having him as a third point guard is probably someone that they'll need. He can at least play some defense, distribute a little bit. He's got to work on his shot, obviously, quite a bit. Very athletic. So I think they'll be viewing him as a third point guard. Probably hasn't proven enough to get a shot as the main backup. But you'd have to imagine they'll keep him around. O'Brien, I don't think he's really kind of like an ISO post-up type of scorer. Doesn't play much defense. I'm not really sure that he has a great fit. My projection is that they probably will move on from him. And then Graham, kind of a big bodied guy, actually started a few games, but more just like a straight defensive player. Hasn't shown much offensive game yet. Big body, but you know, not like an absolute lockdown guy on the wing yet. So we'll see what happens with him. Maybe they like it. It just will depend who else they can get in free agency.
And with his structure, they can just bring him into camp. Like, I think that's kind of what you do in his spot, is you bring him in, and if he's one of your 15 best guys, great. If he's not, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, Christian Wood, they actually had a team option at the minimum for him. They have now declined that. He can be made a restricted free agent, but I doubt they will even make him a qualifying offer, because why wouldn't they have just kept him for a non-guaranteed, I don't remember if it was guaranteed or not, but why wouldn't they just kept him for the minimum? And if you make him a qualifying offer, he can just accept it immediately, and he'll actually make more money than he would have before. So you have to imagine that he almost certainly will be moving on from Charlotte.
Yeah.
What do they have in terms of like future assets, draft picks, if they wanted to make a deal?
Not much. So I had originally misread it and thought that they had Brooklyn's 2018 second, but they actually received the less favorable of, this is an amazing split, the less favorable of Brooklyn or Cleveland's 2018 second round picks. So they'll get Cleveland's 2018 second round pick as a part of the, I think it's the Value A trade. It was a kind of a complicated set of transactions that happened over the course of a couple of years between Cleveland and Philly and various other things.
Yeah, Juan Pablo Valle maybe. But yeah, the Argentina shooting guard that was drafted like 39 or something in 2015, I want to say, by Brooklyn, hasn't done much yet. Yeah, I guess that's about it for these guys. And that's about it for our show. Don't forget about our sponsors today. Harry's. Go to harrys.com/catspace right now to redeem a special offer. $5 off one of their shave sets. And Lyft. If you want to join the ride-sharing company that believes in treating its people better, go to lyft.com/capspace today and you can get a $500 new driver bonus. We'll be back on Wednesday night. Talk about Game 3. Find out whether we got a series or not. Talk to y'all then. And also a reminder that we'll be doing the Twitter NBA show on Wednesday night as well. So check that out at Nate Duncan NBA on Periscope. That's always fun. We take questions during the commercials, do an alternate play-by-play. It's been like 2 weeks since we had a chance to do one of those shows, so we're really looking forward to it. Talk to y'all then.